south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, let me just say for the record now, before we start the show, that vaccines are safe and effective, the border is secure, Biden's computer is Russian disinformation, the dollar is sound, and there is no inflation. And by the way, there will be no dissent allowed on these issues. Now that we've got that settled, all right, let's begin. You know, to explain how Latinos are so gullible when it comes to money and finances, man, that's a huge understatement. Because once again, I ran into a Latino who had a little money who got involved in a Ponzi scheme and got scammed for 10 grand. How'd he get 10 grand when most of them can't scrape 100 bucks together? You'll hear the rest of the story, and it's not pretty. Man, you wouldn't believe it. The social media down here, in Spanish, of course, is just loaded with little ads, pop-up windows, and testimonials from people trying to get you to invest your money in schemes that produce 10, 20, even 50% a month. And any investment, you know, that produces more than 10 or 15% a year, guaranteed, of course, they all say that, is most likely a scam or a Ponzi scheme. Look, when the banks will give you 1 or 2 or even 3%, and suddenly pop-up messages on your smartphone will give you 10 times that rate, or 50 or 100 times that rate, if you can't figure out something stinks already, you deserve to get burned. Yet every single day, and I get the same pop-up windows, people on social media are advertising 10, 20, 30, even 40% a month returns. So anyway, I ran into this guy just a couple days ago, sitting at a table next to me at a coffee shop. He was a friend of the guy I came with, so he introduced him to me. And we got to talking about money, real estate, car loans, you know, the stuff guys usually talk about at their coffee clutches when they're not talking about girls, sports, or their health problems. Anyway, turns out this guy, not a poor guy by any means, he's sort of upper middle class Latin American style. That'd be middle class American style. I'd say he was in his late 30s. He said about 6 months ago, he put a grand into such a scheme, and within 4 or 5 months, he got it all back. They were paying 20% a month. So naturally, he let it ride. Got all that back within 4 months. Naturally, he upped it again. And this time, he got his brother and his sister and a couple of in-laws to invest. They put in 10 grand. And when the next month came, he didn't get paid. So he waited a while. After about 6 weeks, no one was answering the phone anymore. The guy's little office was vacant. And the whole website closed down, virtually disappeared. Man, you know how many times I've heard this story and how many times I've seen cases like that written up in the news and in the papers. But still, people get sucked in by those high interest rates. They never ask how it's possible to get those kind of returns. And most of them don't get into those things cold turkey either. They usually got a friend or a friend of a friend who's been in and he's got his money back. And of course, any person who's in an investment who gets his money back in 3 or 4 months, he rolls it over and puts in more, right? By the way, over the last few years, I've run into a few Latinos who were right in the middle of an ongoing scheme like that, telling me how they were getting this fantastic rate of return and that I should get in too. I always tell them, get out as fast as you can, but they never listen. They try to recruit you to get in while you're trying to tell them to get out. Anyway, there should be lots of red flags anytime you see an investment offered that puts out more than 15% a year. Not a month. That's how a lot of those crypto scams went down on those exchanges, telling you that if you buy their coins or tokens, or even put Bitcoin on their exchange and held it there, they were promising huge rates of return, many multiples of what banks were offering. But truthfully, you know, over the last couple of years, anyone who's been into crypto at all has been tempted by those schemes. After all, if you had some Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever, and it was just sitting in your cold wallet, why not buy some tokens with it or put it on a crypto exchange that paid interest for keeping it there? Part of it's due to the greed factor. The other part is newbies who have gotten in haven't seen any of their friends get gouged like us old timers have. By the way, they call us old timers in crypto early adopters. Luckily, a lot of us early adopters never fell for that. Because we were there when a lot of the earlier scams were perpetrated, like the Mt. Gox thing. I know people who lost 10, 20, 30, even 100 Bitcoin in that Mt. Gox scam. Because lots of early adopters, you know, people who got in 2012, 13, and 14, they didn't have hard wallets like Trezors and Nanos back then, so we had to keep it on an exchange somewhere. Hard wallets didn't exist back then. It was the luck of the draw. Bad luck of the draw if you happen to have had your bitcoins on the Mt. Gox exchange. By the way, you might think the plural of Bitcoin is bitcoins, but a lot of people say it's just Bitcoin. It's like having a bottle of wine. If you have two bottles of wine, it's not two bottles of wines. Though Bitcoin Dan insists the plural of Bitcoin is Bitcoin. And believe me, he should know. He's the one that got all of us in Guatemala and parts north and south on Bitcoin in the first place, when it was well under $100, back in like 2012. Anyway, the jury's out on the plural of Bitcoin. Anyway, us early adopters still smart from that Mt. Gox experience. It was one of the biggest ones, too. It seemed so secure. Yet they ran off with everyone's Bitcoin. So when all of that DeFi stuff came a few years later, us early adopters who went through the Mt. Gox thing were gun-shy about the whole thing. We didn't dive right in. We might have stuck our toe in the water to test it, but we never went all in like the newbies and late arrivals. So in this latest Sam Bankman-Fried FTX fraud debacle, it was mostly the newbies and the late arrivals who got wrecked. The same thing, you know, happens on Wall Street and in the regular brokerage houses. There are just tons of young hotshots who have the golden touch or think they have it. And they do for a while, but they never went through a big downturn like in 2008 or around 2000 when the dot-com bubble hit. They didn't personally experience any of the frauds or blowouts that happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Those guys are all retired or dead. The OGs, the real old guys, they knew a scam and a runaway train when they saw one. But these younger hotshot MBA types who've never seen a financial downturn or a blowout, they're licking their wounds now and the worst is yet to come and they don't even know it. But that's another story. The general economic picture is very grim. I wouldn't want to be up in the States in the epicenter when it finally implodes. I'll watch it down here in Latin America from a nice safe distance. Thank you very much. Anyway, it's hard to feel sorry for people who lose money in stupid get-rich-quick schemes. Hey, I've been there. How about you? Only, luckily enough, I was in my 20s when I got nicked a few times. I didn't have a lot of money to blow, but I learned my lessons young. Back then, to me, $500 was a lot of money. You know, losing $500 here and there, it was painful. But I'm glad now that it happened so early on, making me a bit cautious. And man, since then, I can't tell you how many times people have approached me with amazing so-called opportunities, get-rich-quick schemes, money-making enterprises that just couldn't fail. And you know what? Almost none of those things panned out. Oh, maybe 1 out of 10. But man, I'll tell you, they've got those kinds of scams on steroids down here in Latin America. And believe me, because, you know, you're the rich gringo, right? People will approach you. Just wait till you go to the next big shindig, like a Christmas or a quinceañeros party. By the way, that's one of the few disadvantages to learning Spanish. When your boyfriend or girlfriend's family or the neighbors and the people you associate with finally figure out you can understand them, you have to look out, especially at parties. Every once in a while, you're likely to get a harebrained scheme pitched at you. And as you say no and keep turning them down, giving them all the reasons why you won't invest, you may get tagged as a tightwad, a cheapskate, whatever. But in the end, you'll get the last laugh, at least 9 out of 10 times anyway. But it won't really be funny. Though, you know, with the internet and all those anti-social media sites, that makes for so much more temptation. Like expat Eddie says, it's like having your bedroom door open into a casino. That kind of mass marketing right in your face 24/7 wasn't around before the millennium. Oh, there were pyramid schemes and scams, all right, obviously, but they came at us in slow motion, and I'm truly grateful for that. By the way, speaking of getting scammed, ripped off, and getting sucked into Ponzi schemes, if any of you listeners out there, I'm talking to gringos and expats living in Latin America, have been sucked into one or more of those things, come on, fess up. You know who you are. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. I'd like to hear your story, and maybe our listeners would too. You know, just to keep everyone on their toes. Because, you know, new scams and new twists on old scams are being invented all the time. I mean, look, even 10 years ago, who knew there were so many benevolent Nigerian princes out there with millions locked in bank accounts, and all they need is your bank dats to get at it. Now, speaking of money, ripoffs, scams, are you worried about inflation yet, or a recession, or even a depression? Some of it's here already, and you know the worst is yet to come. How are you going to handle it? You going to tighten your belt, or do you have enough dough to kind of coast right through it? I mentioned a while back how most, if not 90% of Latinos spend 20, 30, even 40% of their income on food. That's when inflation really wreaks havoc. But as far as gringos and expats, I understand that we spend only between 6 and 7% of our income on food. So when food prices double, it hurts a bit, but it only pops us into the low double digits as a percentage of our income. All right, then let's discuss something people don't like to talk about. We all know that gringos and expats, people up in the States, down here, everywhere, are complaining about inflation, right? Funny thing about excessive inflation and recessions and depressions, too. They always seem to rear their ugly heads when people are broke. What a coincidence. Or they say they are broke anyway, but is that really true? Well, it could be true technically, but more than likely due to just bad habits. But is it really true that people up in the States don't make enough dough to live a nice, calm, stable, first world existence? And so if they're in debt, don't have a nest egg, they'll never get on with their plan B? Yet my own family members in and around Chi-Town, Chicago, who always claim they're broke, they spend about $1,200 to $1,500 a month just eating out and or ordering takeout and delivery. I'd have to say the norm up in the States, correct me if I'm wrong, is that people eat at least one meal a day out at a restaurant or carry out, whatever. Now, I'm not going to go into a nostalgic funk about this, but I remember when I was living in the States a long, long time ago, I'd go out to eat maybe once on a weekend. And the only home delivery that existed back then was pizza. So when some of my own family members are spending $1,200 to $1,500 a month eating out, ordering, takeout, and delivery and stuff, I'm sure that's pretty much the story with most everyone up in the States. There's something unnatural about that. Then you've got, I would say, the average city dweller up in the States anyway, spending $6 to $10 a day on Starbucks. It's almost a middle and upper middle class American tradition. That works out to around $200 to $300 a month. Hell, that's what I pay my full-time cleaning lady. Think about it. That's pretty much the salary of an unskilled Latin American worker. There's something really unsettling about that, too. Talk about the most spoiled people in the universe. I'd have to say North American teenagers and young adults take the cake. So I guess another gift fate bestowed on me was that I left the USA before Starbucks arrived. Because, you know, I like my coffee, and I'd probably be spending $300 a month there, too. My twist on that is I buy a pound of the best coffee beans in the world for around $5 or $6. Grind them myself, and if I go through 2 pounds a month, which is about $15 max, I spend between 5 to 10% a month of what my sisters pay for their trips to Starbucks. And I'm not even considering all the gas they waste going back and forth to Starbucks, sometimes twice a day, in their big old gas-guzzling SUVs. And again, on the inflation and shrinking income front, do any of you guys smoke? Cigarettes, that is. It seems to be coming back into fashion, especially with the college and young hipster crowd. What's a pack of Marlboros cost? I know they cost about $10 in Chicago. Same pack of Marlboros here in Latin America cost you around $4. Then, of course, they've got their own homegrown brands like Belmont for, I think, $2 or $3. So anyway, up in the States, if you smoke a pack a day, it's $300 a month. Half a pack, $150. And remember, when we're talking about the cost of such things up in the States, we're talking about after-tax dollars. So you're actually paying about double for everything. Unfortunately, no one really thinks about or wants to consider that. It's obscured in the 100 or so taxes, assessments, and fees baked into the system, whether you like it or not. And if you don't believe me, remember, I've got a list of the 100 or so taxes that you pay, making your tax burden well over 50% of your income. So if you want to ruin your day and get thoroughly depressed, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll send you that list. Now, some of you might be thinking, what's he talking about cigarettes for? I don't smoke. Well, not so fast. You know, it's the cool thing to do when you're kind of a hip 17 to 20-year-old plus. In fact, I've noticed a lot of college-age kids and green and purple-haired pierced people, save the planet types, who smoke. Isn't that kind of odd? You wonder, since college kids and hipster types don't really have jobs, how do they get the money? And just how does that figure into their save the planet stance? By the way, since I'm digressing here, I want to ask all you save the planet and animal types, do you live in a house or a cave? Because, you know, to build the average American home, it takes 22 pine trees. Yep, 22 mature pine trees had to be sacrificed for your comfort and convenience. Did you know that? And for the sake of discussion, consider a mature pine with a height of 80 feet and a diameter of 2 feet. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the average new American home is 2,600 square feet. And you'll find the average American home requires 16,000 board feet of pine to build. And one mature pine tree will give you a little over 750 board feet. Do the math and you'll see it takes 22 mature pines to build a house. And by the way, when you take down a pine tree or any tree, you take down an entire ecosystem. Because one single mature pine tree hosts 30 species of caterpillars, shelters a dozen species of birds, 20 species of mammals, and a dozen species of reptiles and amphibians. And like it or not, a mature pine tree supports more than 100 species of insects. So you cut down one pine tree and you kill or disrupt all that. Even dead trees support a terrific ecosystem. To top that off, the average pine tree absorbs 10 kilograms of CO2 a year. And of course, CO2 is the big culprit in climate change. Now, according to a study carried out by the University of Seville, Spain, 10 pine trees per street will absorb the CO2 levels from approximately 10 vehicles. So one big pine tree completely neutralizes the CO2 emitted from one gasoline-powered car. Bottom line, living a modern life is complicated with many secondary effects. So in fact, we are all save the planet hypocrites. And we haven't even begun to talk about what virtue signaling hypocrites iPhone users are. And they don't even know it. They don't want to know how the sausage is made. Those poor trees. Think of all the millions that had to be killed to clear land to grow crops, whether for human or animal consumption. I'm doing my part, though. As much as I hate it, I've switched to paper straws. So hey, if you really want to save the planet and make any kind of meaningful impact at all, and you don't want to be a complete hypocrite, live in a cave or kill yourself. Just saying. By the way, all you backpackers, I have a bone to pick with you too. I see them everywhere down here, and they're all the save the planet types. Nothing wrong with that, but they talk the talk, but not the walk. You get into any kind of discussion at all with them, and they start telling you about how we're ruining the planet as they text away on their slave labor-produced smartphones, sip cans of Coke, and fidget with the shoelaces on their $200 Timberland hiking boots. You know, the ones with the petroleum-derived high-tech Gore-Tex heels? All right, let's take an email from one of our Daves. I think this is Dave number 22. He says, Johnny, I love your podcast. I listen intently to each one. Your podcasts are funny, educational, inspiring. He says, I would trade in this two-bit hustled USA in a moment if I could get my wife to see just how corrupt the U.S. government has always been and will forever be. But she is just one of those people, bless her heart, that's just a little resistant to change. If I could just convince her, I would pack up today, load up a couple of suitcases and head to Guatemala and never look back. As for me, he says, I've lived overseas before in New Zealand and absolutely loved the experience. But that was over 25 years ago. However, in saying that, my wife has never been out of the States other than a Caribbean gringo vacation. On the trail, you know. And that doesn't really count. But the point of this email is to just ask you one question, though. How did you learn your Spanish so well? He says, I know you couldn't have gone to one of those helicopter schools. I bet your girlfriend has a lot to do with your fluent Spanish. Plus, the fact that you've lived south of the border for such a long time. I know some Spanish myself, and I'm smart enough not to fall for the stinking turista Spanish courses and classes that are so readily available. By the way, I've gone back into your podcast archives, and I'm working my way backwards just to make sure I'm not asking repetitive questions. Hope I'm not. In closing, he says, let me just say I'm so grateful for your podcast and I'm hopeful that one day we can meet. Signed, Dave, number 26, I think. Anyway, he signs off Dave, number one enemy, he says, of progressive Democrats and sold-out, pussy-whipped Republicans. By the way, Dave has that Spanish question and another one, too. We'll get to that later. Well, Dave, for one thing, you know, I've done 1,201 shows. And believe it or not, I still get emails from people saying, Johnny, you're repeating yourself. Then, right after that, I get questions from people that I've answered a number of times before in past shows, but they're coming from people who are new or fairly new listeners to the show. So I definitely have a kind of a balancing act to perform here. How to give you current info and current boots on the ground stories, mixed in with some of the stuff we've gone over even a number of times. And of course, things are changing here in Latin America all the time, especially since this COVIDiot thing. There are countries, cities, and places I used to recommend a lot and I don't recommend anymore. So oftentimes when people say, is so-and-so a good place to have my plan B? Or please give me some recommendations. Well, they're not the same anymore. Especially since in some countries, socialism is on the march. For example, Bolivia and Paraguay used to be kind of neutral on my list. And now I don't much recommend either of them, since the government's been taken over by somewhat hardline socialists. And Paraguay, well, like I said, I used to be neutral about it. But since people have been contacting me and stories are floating in, that started about a year or two ago, with gringos and expats living there, telling me about how they've been scammed in the worst way by lawyers, expediters, real estate agents, and even government officials. People are telling me that Paraguay really is the wild, wild west. Not in a good way. Not much of a soft landing at all. And you better know Spanish if you're going down there. Of course, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua have always been off my list. With Mexico, Brazil, except for a few areas. And of course, Costa Rica. They're next on my Latin American country feces list, but for other reasons. No, I'm still kind of neutral on Colombia, but I definitely stay away from the big cities. The gringos are trying to do a Costa Rica on those places, so there goes the cost of living, huh? But it's a huge country, and there are still lots and lots of places off the gringo tourist trail, where the gringo advantage is alive and well. Only they, too, have voted in a socialist president who promises to tax the rich. And in Latin America, you know who the rich are, right? What we'd call in the States, the middle class is an up. That means if you have a plan B in Colombia, you will be considered rich and get gouged by that proposed wealth tax. So then what about Argentina? You know, I actually like the place, but I'd never want to outright own a business, real estate, or a home there, which sort of defeats the purpose of living in a foreign country, huh? You want to do some investing there, at least own a condo, apartment, or homestead. Now, in regards to Argentina, there's lots of bad news coming from that country on the financial front. For example, if you got a dollar account, you can only take out $200 a month. Imagine you're retired and having your Social Security direct deposited there, and you can only pull out $200 a month. Well, it gets worse. This week, the U.S. and Argentina agreed to have their tax agencies automatically share data about citizens' banking and investments in each other's countries. In other words, U.S. banks and investment firms are opening up their books to the Argentine government. The government in Buenos Aires says that will uncover more than $100 billion that's been hidden from the Argentine tax system and sheltered in the U.S. Now, if you remember those FATCA laws that required all banks to share information with the U.S., a couple of years back those were enacted. Well, that partially opened the books. So a certain amount of financial data was already being shared between the U.S. and Argentina on a case-by-case basis. But this new law will give Argentine taxing authorities automatic access to information about such investments, whether they're made as individuals or through companies and trusts. Nothing will be secret. They'll be opening up the books on everything that's owned by an Argentine citizen. Turns out an early accord Argentina signed with the U.S. in 2017 was supposed to uncover all the Argentine tax cheaters in the U.S. Though in all that time, 5 years, only 68 Argentine citizens were nabbed. However, with this new accord, the IRS and Argentina's AFIP, which is their IRS, will share information automatically, resulting in a flood of data, not only about cash held in bank accounts, corporate profits, etc., but with rents collected and real estate investments and deals, too. Their plan is to nab thousands of tax evaders. According to the Argentine government, there's an estimated $100 billion in undeclared wealth being held in the U.S. alone by their citizens. It's amazing what lengths totally bankrupt countries will go to empty the pockets of their own citizens. Anyway, for that, and a lot of other reasons, I'd never want to live in Argentina. Anyway, if you're interested, my two top picks for Plan B destinations in Latin America are still Guatemala and El Salvador. With the DR and a couple of selected places in Honduras coming in with honorable mentions. Then there's Chile and Uruguay. Expensive and boring. With Chile's government heavily socialist too. And Uruguay's government even more socialist. But somehow, their citizens don't seem to care. There's not much enforcement, so that's in their favor too. By the way, other than Cuba and Venezuela, Uruguay's got the highest percentage of adults working in government than any other Latin American country. It's a pretty revolting development, all right, making the bureaucracy and paperwork immense. Then again, enforcement is extremely lax, so they've got that in their favor. But, like I said, if you're a real active person, it's a pretty boring country. There's not a lot to do. Extremely retro, but some people are into that. Hey, I know lots of people whose dream scenario is to sit in a hammock by the beach and watch the surf roll in. Nothing wrong with that, but it's not for me. Have you tried it? Well, for most people, even if it's been their retirement dream all their life, it gets old pretty fast. In fact, a couple of my gringo expat friends who have two houses, one in the city and one on the beach, which is also sort of a dream gringo aspiration, right? Well, I know at least a half dozen of them who've come to regret buying those beach houses because now it's a chore to visit them. They bought the place, they thought it was a great idea at the time, and after a few years, and a couple-hour drive each way from the main house, it's just not much fun anymore. Now they feel they have to visit it once in a while because they've got an investment and they don't want it just sitting there doing nothing. Reminds me of all those people that got into timeshares years ago. Timeshares and beer can collections. Man, they've got to be two of the worst investments of all time. Talk about throwing 10 or 15 grand into the crapper. Plus a yearly maintenance payment too. Anyway, I've been rambling here. I never got to Dave's question about how I learned my Spanish. Well, you'll never really learn it well unless you practice with someone on a regular basis. And since the first three girlfriends I had down here spoke English, I could never really learn my Spanish. Then my fourth girlfriend, who was a non-English speaker, that's when it really kicked in. So I was down here about 5 years before I really started understanding anyone. Though over the years, one of the tricks I've used that's helped me a lot in being able to read and write a little Spanish, you know, when you have to, like when you're communicating with a lawyer or a bank or a utility company. Well, I started browsing the local classified ads in Spanish. You know, fun stuff. Cars, real estate, knickknacks, and household appliances, etc. That's a great way to pick up on the vocabulary. Then I went a step farther years ago, too, when one of my laptops died. I had the Windows program installed in Spanish. I know that might sound crazy or even dangerous, but it's not as crazy as you'd think because you can switch back and forth, which I never ended up doing. For example, now if I go into my Word program, everything you see in the header and footer are in Spanish. But since you knew it so well in English, you used it for so many years, you can make the transition easy because it kicks right in. Now, as far as those automatic translation programs like Google Translate or even Yahoo and all those other mail services have a translation button, right? I find they're sort of a crutch, more of a hindrance than a help. You come to rely on them like people rely on calculators and they just can't add, subtract, multiply, or divide longhand anymore. Now, as far as Spanish immersion at a house, that works, man. I did it for a couple of weeks, but you have to eat with the family and you can't refuse them. You know, you're their guest. And man, I just couldn't deal with that. Let me put it this way. When I was there, the dog, under the table, had a beggar's banquet. But man, I tell you, after a couple of weeks, you do learn your Spanish, or at least the basic conversational Spanish. Oh, another thing. I might be picky, but I hate sharing bathrooms with people. That's why I could never be a backpacker. That's what you'll be up against if you have an immersion family. Because remember, practically 100% of those families are middle or lower middle class Latin style, which means no AC, you eat what they eat, occasional driveway chickens, dirty dogs jumping on your lap. But the worst thing for me was sharing the bathroom with the family. Now, I'm not trying to be a prig or classist or anything. And maybe if I had to do it all over and I was 22 years old again, it wouldn't have bothered me a bit. But hey, you get set in your ways, and it's nice to know the hair that's clogging up your shower drain is yours. Oops, we're getting towards the end of the show now. To be continued.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos!